It's Cascadia News Now. I am Shamaya Contouris with Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham back together after a long hiatus as KMRA Studios has moved to its new location. We're in the bottom, the bowels of the Bellingham National Bank building. I want to say, first of all, this is a test show, so bear with us. If we flub up, we're just going to see what happens tonight, but we still have a lot to talk about. I also want to say a special thank you to Tim Johnson, who was instrumental in helping us work with the great Bob Hall to get this space as a donation. And so thank you, Daylight Properties. Thank you, Bob Hall. But thank you, Tim Johnson.
Here we are in the vault.
In the vault, in the bowels, where all the good news is. And as per usual, we have a whole lot to talk about tonight. Elections, another Fergie report, Betsy DeVos and our public schools, and the Trans Mountain Pipeline. But first, I just want Dave to sneak in with a brief heads up about our own SCOTUS, and, well, at least the Supreme Court of Washington. So what is that, SCOTWA?
That's kind of an unfortunate term. Previously on this show, we talked a lot about Initiative 940, which would have changed the way communities interact with their police and the threshold under which a police officer could be prosecuted for actions they perform while in the course of performing their duty. And that came to a head with a commission back in 2016 who presented their findings to the legislature. Legislature did not adopt those findings as law, so it became an initiative that people went out and gathered signatures for. They got enough signatures. The legislature, and right at the end of their session, saw that was great. Got together with police groups and wound up totally scrapping the initiative, rewriting all of it, and putting forward their own version, which canceled the initiative and totally and utterly befuddled a lot of us who were watching, because it didn't really have a legal basis. There wasn't a legal basis for what they had done. And of course, immediately, Tim Iman, local malcontent, filed suit against the legislature with cause, because
stepped into the breach.
Yeah, they didn't really have the legal authority, I don't think, to do what they did. And the Supreme Court of Washington State will be hearing the case on June 28th. So what could happen there is they could say, no, this is all fine. What the legislature did is now law. They could say, no, the initiative has to go on the ballot because it collected enough signatures and was signed off on by the Secretary of State. Or they could say both go on the ballot and we could have two nearly identical things. And or they could kick it back and we could wind up with nothing. So we're going to keep an eye on that.
Now, they've accepted it, though. They're going to hear arguments. Is that right?
That's correct.
Because there's always that option with the court, which is we don't want to hear it. And therefore, it stands.
So, yeah.
But this is interesting. Usually, when you get the court saying that they want to look at a thing, they really do want to look at it. So this will be interesting.
Yeah, and from a legal standpoint, it is an interesting question. Can the legislature essentially hijack an initiative, keep it off the ballot, and turn it into whatever they want? And really, that's scary. That's a scary power for any legislature in the country to have. So it'll be interesting to watch. And
we didn't get a chance. Basically, we got the signatures. We did not, as a state public, get a chance to weigh in on this. And just to reiterate, the legislature got together with local police forces, and what they passed can be considered a watered down version.
It was a compromise. You know, the group behind the initiative supports the legislature's version. Most police agencies in the state support the legislature's version. So it splits the difference a little bit. It's not exactly what had been proposed. Mostly it was clarification of some vague points, like what constitutes an officer's paramount duty in a situation where there are people who are injured.
So hooray, Tim Iman.
Yeah.
I mean, for this one time, don't hold it against me, but for this one time, I'm kind of glad it was challenged because it carries a lot of weight for future initiatives as well. So we will be tracking that. Go right ahead and write to Scott Waugh. I mean, you can always address the Supreme Court of Washington State. Whether or not they hear you is a different story. But speaking of stories, let's get to the big one that impacts Canada, the United States, British Columbia, and particularly Washington and Whatcom County, and that is the Trans Mountain Pipeline that Trudeau insisting that the project was in Canada's national interest and insisting that it is a pivotal part of Canada's economic future has purchased but intends to sell it later. Tim, you've been talking about this a lot in Cascadia Weekly.
Yeah, I have. I've been tracking this story for a long time because even though it is happening in another country, it's happening in another country that's 10 miles away. So it has a big impact locally. And it's a very dynamic story because the relationship of the provinces to the federal government of Canada is quite a bit different than the relationship of the states to the federal government in the United States. And the provinces have a lot more authority and power. They also have the ability to wrestle with each other, I think, with a lot greater effect, and this became a turf war between the province of Alberta, where the tar sands oil is packaged and
they're very in favor
up.
Of this.
They're very in favor of it. It's a huge part of the Alberta economy. It's unfortunate because Alberta is such a beautiful province. I really wish that they were investing in tourism rather than ripping up tar sands.
Well, Alberta was separated from Texas at birth, and that's where they get their money, right. And that's
correct.
Where their bread and butter is.
And this project, it's what's called a twinning of the pipeline's capacity. It's already an existing pipeline, and what they want to do is essentially triple its capacity. And so a lot of the sort of pushback that environmental groups might do has been truncated a little bit because the impacts are already there. I mean, and the rights of way and everything are already established. The issue for Salish Sea is that if you triple the capacity of a pipeline, you triple probably the number of vessels on Puget Sound, and we're just now becoming aware of the impacts of that vessel traffic on marine life, particularly orcas. And you also triple the risk of a major spill in the Salish Sea, the impacts of which really are not unknowable at this moment and incalculable in terms of their impact. So it's a major project, and the Canadian government, I think the larger meta story of this is about 2 years ago, I think the Canadian government made a judgment that they were going to not support several pipeline projects that were proposed and underway, but they were going to allow this one. And so this one kind of gets a little bit of a nod from the Trudeau government. And then last week or 2 weeks ago.
A big nod, depending on.
Yeah, then the Trudeau government last week or 10 days ago said that they were going to buy. There was some question. The financiers of the thing were kind of lukewarm on it because of a lot of uncertainties, even about its economic viability and feasibility, whether they're going to be able to get money out of it. So the Trudeau government stepped in and said, you know, we'll just buy the pipeline for $4.5 billion Canadian. The amount the Canadian government's going to have to invest is probably going to be far greater than $4.5 billion. And
they do say they're going to turn around and sell it.
They will try to sell it. But what they essentially did was they nationalized this pipeline. And since they are the regulatory agency as well, a good judge does not have a financial interest in the things that a judge is judging, and the Canadian government has put themselves into this position of not only being the client but also being the, you know, the regulator of the product. So It's not over yet. There are some hurdles to be cleared, but as I wrote, this is a big thumb on the scale of this project moving forward.
Well, it's especially disappointing because we've got a lot of experience in this hemisphere with oil cleanup, unfortunately. But this isn't something that we've really dealt with before. This bitumen is awful. It's heavy. It'll sink, but not all the way. And a cleanup project would be much bigger in scale than anything we've seen before and here in Puget Sound.
Right. And the other thing I think is that there have been dozens and dozens of these projects proposed, and all of them have been stopped in one way or another. This one might be the one that gets through. And I think that the reason that is because the sorts of regulatory issues are not as strong in Canada as they are have been in the United States, if you can believe that. I mean, it's amazing to me. But the tribes, the indigenous tribes of British Columbia, they don't have the same pushback rights that that U.S. tribes have used when they have tried to stop things like the Dakota pipeline and the Cherry Point coal terminal, and they've played a big role. Down on the Columbia River, the ports played a big role in pushback, and Department of Natural Resources, and these were agencies that were doing their duty. Those kinds of agencies don't seem to be as potent in the federal government of Canada. British Columbia has pushed back pretty hard on this, but even their powers are limited.
So I do want to say that there have been some pushback responses, let's say. Denise Douglas of the First Nations in BC representative said, informed consent, we have not been informed properly. We have not been given consent. Also, the Wild Salmon Defenders Alliance, Edie Gardner, said Trudeau is, quote unquote, deluded. If he thinks the project is compatible with the environment, he said he did not have political mandate to buy a pipeline at this huge price in terms of taxpayers' dollars, but also in terms of the destruction of what sustains us. And it's interesting because I think Trudeau has been perceived or would like to be perceived as an environmental leader. Why is this so – it seems so out of character for me, to him.
Well, I'll get to that. But one thing I want to add is that today is Wednesday. There is a major meeting of the environmental groups in Seattle tomorrow, Thursday, where they are going to do some pushback. One of the things that has happened with this is that because it's happening across an international boundary, Washington State hasn't really been – heavily involved until it got nationalized, and then Governor Inslee had some things to say about it. Seattle somehow is suddenly activated. Bellingham is becoming activated on it. So something that was flying under the radar has become very prominent. And I think the answer to your question, though, is that, the Trudeau government stopped a lot of these. And it's almost like in the interest of fairness, they have to let something go forward. They can't stop. We might think that they should be able to stop it all. But I think the Trudeau government felt like in the interest of fairness, they had to let one of, you know, a dozen projects move forward through their process. And unfortunately, I think the Canadian government has decided that this pipeline is part of the economic future of Canada. It's unfortunate in one way because they could take the millions and millions and billions of dollars they're going to spend on this pipeline, refitting Canada for a new energy future, which a lot of people think is a much better, wiser use of limited, you know, federal dollars to do that. But I think that I just think that Trudeau was trying to be fair in allowing one thing to move through some process. I can't comment whether he thinks he's being fair on the most recent thing where they essentially nationalized their pipeline.
And it's very disappointing. I mean, I'm glad that the groups are meeting, and I'm glad they're meeting here. Washington State just got called out by a group from a group event of Department of Interior, Department of Energy, staffers in Washington specific or in Montana, excuse me, specifically called out Washington State for being against energy for, you know, our standing up and shutting down all of these terminals. And I'm hopeful that they'll get their act together. Like you mentioned, Tim, Canada's system is very different, and British Columbia's government has been really weak. They've had a hard time in recent years keeping a government together. So I'm hopeful that they can get it together.
So one last question is, now I'm pretty knee-jerk pipeline bad, and there's a lot of reasons to be knee-jerk pipeline bad. The fact that Canada is a socialistic democracy, is it in some ways a good thing that this is not privately owned, that this is, as you said, nationalizing a pipeline?
The impacts are the same, and as we saw, one of the things that happened in the news this week was that the president and vice president of Trans Mountain, they got million-dollar bonuses because they were able to push this forward. So in a sense, the Canadian government has underwritten the bonus of a private business in Texas that the CEO and the vice president get a bunch of money in their pocket. Trans Mountain will continue to operate the pipeline, continue to pull the profits out of the pipeline. I mean, in a sense, the Canadian government is just going to be a shareholder, and they operate in the realm of a shareholder. But the impacts of the pipeline are the same whether it's run by the government or run by some private industry. And so the biggest thing of concern, you know, is there's always the X factor of whether you're going to have a spill. But what is not an X factor is the increase in vessel traffic, which has already been determined to be of detriment to marine life in Salish Sea.
Right, absolutely. And as Tim mentioned, if you are listening to this on Wednesday, that this week, and if you're listening to it this week and or next week, then this past week, there's going to be a big action in Seattle, and we will be reporting on it in upcoming weeks and as that develops. So for now, let's turn to everybody's head of education, Betsy DeVos. We all love her so much. So a couple of things about Betsy DeVos. First of all, she, in the past week, I believe, said to a school safety commission that they will not focus on guns, specifically in their role in school shootings. Schools should be, according to DeVos, able to decide whether to report undocumented students. Different story. Let's stick with the guns. That it is not in her purview, she says, to deal with education and gun control in the schools.
Well, you know, I'm of two minds there, right? The issue that this country has with guns is linked to school shootings, but that is not a Department of Education specific issue. But specifically stating at the outset, we will not be talking about this, is nuts. You know, that's
is that your political term?
Yeah, you can't talk about the problem without addressing a major part of the problem. You know, if people weren't bringing guns into schools, there wouldn't be these shootings. That's really basic. And to say we're going to address all of this except, I mean, that's like, you know, going to a cardiologist and saying, you know, I want to work on a plan to make myself healthier, but we are not going to talk about my diet. I am going to eat whatever I want, but we're going to figure out some other way.
Yeah, I see it a little bit different. And one of my big complaints about this current administration is you get all the bad and not much of the good. And I would say that if the Secretary of Education in the United States was really focusing like a laser on public education and improving that, then she's well within her right to say that's not something that we want to get into right now. But the problem is she's saying that that's something we don't want to get to right now, and she's not focusing on education issues either. So, I mean, it's an abdication of any responsibility either for the things that you might consider to be peripheral and adjunct to education, like school shootings. I don't think that they are peripheral and adjunct, but let's just say that they are. And you want to put those to the side in order to make schools better. Well, we're not getting better schools either through this department.
I understand what you're saying, if she was effective in other areas. And to me, regardless of if she's effective in other areas, the question is, do school shootings impact education in America, period? And the answer is yes.
Yeah, and the Department of Education should have response plans for school shooting incidents. They should have guidelines they can give to local schools to say, you know, this is what we think are best practices. This is how to talk to kids who've been through that. You know, that's their role. And they're not doing any of that.
Or at a minimum, they have an opinion on the issue of school shooting and they don't abdicate having any opinion at all. It's like, well, we don't have any opinion on that. Well, maybe whether or not they establish a policy, maybe the federal government should have an opinion on whether children should be shot in a school.
Right. And so now let's get into our other area about Secretary of Education, and an area that hits us a little closer to home, and it is about Betsy DeVos and their position, the Secretary of Education, Education Department's position on undocumented students regarding immigration authorities. According to Betsy DeVos, schools should be able to decide individually whether or not to report undocumented students in the middle of school, I guess. And she said, quote, "I think that's a school decision and that is a local community decision." And our Washington State Public Instruction, Chris Rakedahl, said that, quote, "It is the paramount duty of the state to make ample provision for the education of all children residing within its borders without distinction or preference on account of race, color, caste, or sex." And if you think I read that with emphasis because I have an opinion, I do. But something I strongly support. But why don't you break it down for us, Dave?
Well, we talked a few months ago about the national crisis of, you know, just feeding kids at school and how many kids are going having to jump through all sorts of hoops and things like that just to get food. And, you know, the thing that really stuck with me then and on that issue and this one is that this shouldn't be an issue. Of all of the things that kids have to worry about while they're at school, having someone demand they prove their status isn't one of them. It isn't anyone's business on that campus what anyone's immigration status is. That doesn't affect any part of their education. It does not affect any part of what school life should be. People should, you know, feel safe at school. They should be worried about, you know, tests and social nonsense and whatever it is kids are doing these days. This is insane. This is basically inviting people, adults, to challenge children in a place where they should be safe. They should be okay.
Right. And I guess I see it maybe a color a little differently, which is I just consider this to be an empty statement by the Education Department, because what we've seen, and we've seen it a lot in this state, we've seen it in other states too, is immigration, there is a criminal side of immigration and then there is the civil side of immigration, and nobody, police, sheriff's office, nobody wants to try to enforce the civil side of immigration law. And I don't expect the schools will want to do that either. And, you know, I mean, if I were a school administrator, my immediate question would be, are you going to give us money to do that? Mm. Because if you're not going to give us money to do that, then we're not going to do that.
And even if you were going to give us money.
Exactly. I mean, I'm just saying that from the standpoint of, as a school administrator, you're asking for a major cost. You're asking us to get involved in a subject that we have no jurisdiction or experience in whatsoever. And what we saw, what we've seen in Bellingham, City of Bellingham, we saw what we've seen in Whatcom County and in Washington State, law enforcement doesn't want to do this, so why should schools?
Right. I'm trying really hard to devil's advocate this. And the only thing I can come up with, obviously, you know, I'm trying to think for someone else. The only thing I can come up with is if somebody thought incredibly that giving education and educational knowledge to an immigrant or child of immigrants took away educational knowledge from somebody, a child who was a citizen, which is ludicrous.
Yeah, and we have public schools in this country because we recognize that educating children is a public good.
Absolutely.
Uneducated children lead to uneducated adults, and we don't have much use for uneducated adults. We all need everyone as educated as we can get them to be for our society to function properly. And, you know, Tim, I'm not worried about school administrators. I don't think most school administrators care. What I'm worried about are people like that idiot in that viral video a couple weeks ago screaming at people demanding to know their citizenship status at a Starbucks. And it's I'm worried about people hanging out outside of schools, feeling empowered to challenge children.
Right, and I'm not. I have no argument with you that we're living in a very corrosive time that is not, that none of that is productive in any way.
Absolutely. Okay, moving on. It's time for one of my favorite segments, and I don't have my Bow Chicka Wow Wow music, but it is time for the Fergie Love Fest, because everyone knows that we love our Washington Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, and he has recently taken on, like David and Goliath, Facebook and Google, and he is charging them with not having complied with our own PDC, our Public Disclosure Commission campaign?
Commission,
and that they have been bad, bad people in terms of advertising and political campaigns. Take it away, Dave.
So here in Washington State, back in the 70s, people got together, passed an initiative. This is how a lot of our stories start.
And, once upon a time.
You know, the goal of which was to shine light on how money is spent in politics. And because of that, Washington State has some of the best political advertising laws from the standpoint of a voter and citizen. It's probably less fun for advertisers. But in that series of laws, you have to, if you are taking money to run political advertisements, you have to record who spent that money. You have to record who the audience was supposed to be, who it actually was, you know, who that money was actually supposed to support, not just who gave it to you, and, you know, a whole list of things that you have to have publicly available so that people can, you know, review and see where that advertisement came from, who's spending what to support who. And online advertisers do not do that. They have not done that. And it's a problem. It's led to a system where there are basically different rules for online advertisements versus radio and TV and newspapers. And that's bad for all of us. And it's especially bizarre because the online advertisers have all that data. They have all of our data.
And all this, the data.
It seems like it would be really easy for them to provide, but they have been really resistant because they don't want any regulation of this whatsoever. So this is the product of a couple of activists in Seattle who have been working very hard to pressure Facebook and Google, especially in after the 2016 elections, who finally filed complaints with the PDC, filed complaints with the state attorney general's office stating that they were planning on suing. And the state attorney general said, I got this.
Yeah. And it's an interesting
– hold one quick question. I have a quick question because I'm getting confused. Now, if somebody were to pay a commercial radio station for an ad, that's very clear. It's in Washington State. It's for a Washington State candidate. But Google and Facebook are amorphous. So if somebody – like Doug Erickson's had a lot of outside money come in to support him. If somebody paid Facebook, or Google, whose headquarters are not in Washington State – and a PAC who is not in Washington State paid money for a candidate that was in Washington State, but the transaction existed outside of the state, should that be something that has to be reported?
Yes. And, you know, I get the direction of that. But when I buy an ad on Facebook or Twitter or Google, I get to select where that ad shows up and where it doesn't. If I don't want people in Washington State to see that ad, I can make that happen. If I want to target people who live within 10 miles of downtown Bellingham, I can make that happen.
Well, I would look at it from a different angle, which is that the attorney general, one of the jobs of the attorney general is to enforce the laws of the state of Washington. And whether this is an online advertisement or whether this is a print advertisement or radio advertisement, it's still subject to state laws and state public disclosure. And so even though the medium, it might be different. This is like, you know, this is an online advertisement. He still needs to enforce the laws as they're written in the state of Washington. And he's been a great champion of taking on these things. We have, as you said, Dave, we have one of the greatest public disclosure, sets of public disclosure and sunshine laws in the nation.
What's a sunshine law?
It is a transparency. You can follow the money. It's a very important tool for voters.
So it's like shedding the light
it
on.
It is shedding light on. Mm-hmm. On voters of Washington set up the PDC originally by initiative, and the legislature has honored that, and they've actually improved it. And so we have an opportunity here to have our laws enforced.
And I want to remind you that you are tuned into Cascadia News Now, and you're listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham, 102.5 KAVZ Deming and Van Zandt. That's Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and I'm Shamaya Contouris. And we always have lots to say about Attorney General. We'll be tracking that. But now we have so much to report since filing week was a couple weeks ago. And there are so many candidates. And as a matter of fact, the only place that may have more candidates is California. So let's take a moment, shall we? It's not really local news, but let's take a moment and talk about this week's California primary. And the reason it's important to us is because they have, in the past couple of years, become a top two state like us. A top two state, very briefly, means in most normal places, you would have each party has their own little primary, and then the best person of that party moves on to the general. That's how it was intended to work in the United States for a long time. And then Washington got the quote-unquote bright idea that, oh, let's just pick the two people who get the most votes. It doesn't matter what party they are. And now we're in the system, but California's in the system too. So California had a primary where there were bazillions of candidates yesterday. And who wants to jump in and explain what happened?
Well, I can jump in on it a little bit. I mean, the top two primary came about because of a challenge by the two parties, the Democrats, the Republicans, of the primary systems that were in place prior in California and Washington. They overturned them, and so we put this thing in. I don't think it's a perfect system by any means, and we might talk about some of the things that make it wacky. But there, I guess what I would characterize as happening is there are a lot of people that are very excited to run for office, and these people all running together towards the same goal sort of block each other and eclipse each other. And you could have situations where all the Democrats have, even though they're going to get 80% of the vote for them, they eclipse each other sufficiently so that a Republican that got 20% comes in on the top of the line, or maybe two Republicans that got 20% come in on top. So what California was looking at was this massive jumble that could create chaos in taking what the Democrats' goal is to take the House of Representatives this fall. That looked like it was going to create chaos, but actually things seem to have worked out really well. And the Democrats seem to have been able to get out the message about which candidates were best qualified in their various positions they were running for. And it looks like the things that we were all of us pundits and everything were sweating about and wringing our hands about did not come to pass. And it looks like California
cough,
is,
Tim Johnson, cough.
Yeah. And that California is well positioned now to put really good candidates forward in an election this fall.
Yeah, and just to talk briefly about election systems, there are a lot of variations across the country in the way that we elect our representatives, and some of them are straight up bonkers, like Georgia and Louisiana. And ours is not what I would consider great. It's not an ideal for me, but the way we pick our candidates is a really difficult question, because the people that we have to make those sorts of decisions are people who will be candidates themselves. And we get into a scary place of people choosing who can run against them. And so, yeah, it's a difficult system. I don't think it's the best system, but it was kind of fun to watch last night all of the people stressing over California's 10th and 48th districts, because as far as I know, the 10th is still too close to call to determine if a Democrat made it through. But it was very exciting.
So as relates to our own slate of people who are running for positions, and I was giving you a little bit of a hard time, Tim,
right,
because you had recently written in the Cascadia Weekly about the 42nd district.
The 40th district.
You're right. The 40th district, where Representative Chris Litton is stepping down. and a mess of people who are in various degrees, but many of them are pretty well qualified. The 40th district, this legislative district, covers a small part of south of Whatcom County. It covers Skagit County. It covers San Juan, the San Juan Islands. So it's a bit diverse. Just as a reminder, because we harp on this a lot, but just as a reminder, we have no representation from Bellingham, none in Olympia, not from the 42nd, not from the 40th, no one. So that's always a factor. But taking a look at that slate, just as a brief rundown, Rudd Brown, who is our current Whatcom County Council Chair, Alex Rammel from Stand.Earth, Extreme Oil Campaign, Deborah Lakanoff from the Swinomish Nation, Tom Pasma, longtime Democrat, State Committee Man, Daniel Miller, I don't know anything about him, Michael Petrich, they're the Republican Party candidates. You have bemoaned the number of the 40th District candidates in concern. Out of everybody that I mentioned, that is four Democratic candidates, two Republican candidates in the system that we were just explaining. Conceivably, all the Democrats could get together, split the heck out of their support for those people. Both Republicans could get in, and then in the general, we would have these two relative unknowns representing right. Republican Party.
And I guess I would push back a little bit on the word bemoan, because I think the chance of that is actually very small. And the reason I think that is because the percentage of people who are likely to vote for Democrats in the 40th district is very high. It's got to be 65%.
At least.
And that gives capacity for four Democrats to run. Had three run, I guess my frustration was, had three Democrats run in that race, you actually could conceivably have two Democrats running in that race. Into November, you'd have, and they would be in a struggle to out-liberal each other, and that would be a fun. I think that would be a fun and interesting.
And one
thing
could argue more representative of the 40th district,
right? Because what you're going to have then, what you're guaranteed to have is a Republican is going to be in the top two, and then you're going to have a standard and fairly static kind of debate between a Democrat and a Republican running. In, I think, which is one of the most blue districts in the United States, certainly in the state of Washington, it's one of the most blue districts there is. It would be kind of exciting to see, let's put it into a different framework and say, a Hillary person running against a Bernie person.
Oh, I'm so tired of that example.
I know. I understand that, but I'm talking about listeners, maybe that would be something that they would, rather than having somebody from the far right and somebody from the middle left, you might actually have an interesting, unique, dynamic conversation in the 40th district.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. The example that we've seen in Washington State in recent years is like the 36th district in Seattle, which is also very blue and is, you know,
King County.
One where two Democrats advance. And they do get more time for deeper issues other than, you know, well, they want to tax us all to death. Well, I don't even know what the preferred nomenclature is now. But it is disappointing that fewer Republican candidates didn't get in. I think the total unknownness of the current candidates, I could not find Daniel Miller with any sort of online presence.
Horse.
But, you know, he is a perennial candidate. Yeah, it's disappointing to me that we have so few candidates overall.
It is interesting, though, that the four Democrat candidates for the 40th, for Chris Litton's seat, are pretty well known. Yeah. I mean, Rudd Brown is county council chair. He's been on the county council forever. Alex Rammel is a powerhouse when it comes to sustainable connections and oil issues and environment issues. I remember Deborah Lakanoff. Not only has she been involved in Swinomish, but she's been involved in tribal politics for a long time and representing tribal issues on a larger level. Tom Pasma, he has been around forever and been a quarter horse of the Democratic Party, so to speak. And so isn't it conceivable, because it's such a blue district, we could still have two Democrats move forward?
I don't see that there's I don't see there's a possibility of that, not a big possibility of it. But the interesting thing is here there's no question that these are four excellent candidates, and they all have their own basis of support. And in fact, that almost feeds into the problem of this kind of a blocking, eclipsing thing, because they're all going to draw from these very unique, and they're all qualified, and they're all capable, and they all know how to campaign. They're great candidates, and I think that the distinction you might make, like let's take one of the races in California where there's one person who's outstanding and everybody else who's in there is kind of an amateur. They haven't campaigned before. They're not great. Well, that one person who knows what they're doing is probably going to sail through. Here, it's really a toss-up which one of these four is going to make it through. But because there are four, I think it's extremely, extremely likely that. Because where are the Republicans going to put their vote? They're not going to vote for – and let's say that there is 30% Republicans in the 40th district. That person's going to get 30%.
Well, before the numbers guy, Dave, jumps in, I'll just say conceivably one or two of these candidates from the 40th could be absolute powerhouses in fundraising and in getting their name and getting their message out there. It could become sort of a top two race. And because of the blueness of the district, I'm not giving up that hope. Now let's hear from the numbers guy.
I don't think that's totally impossible. I mean, like I mentioned, Miller does not have a significant online presence. I believe he's run in some election in each of the last three. I might be wrong. It might be two, but I know he's been on the ballot a couple of times, and people kind of get a fatigue about that. And Michael Petrich has an interesting story. Doesn't really speak to me, but being a military contractor and involved in some manner in the Balkans War in the late 90s, that might speak to some people. But neither of them really seem like standout. I am motivated to vote down ballot for these people. Folks, so it could conceivably.
To be fair, Tim, it is true that there are whatever dog ticket people who will vote for an R or vote for a D because they always do. And so, you know, you can't deny that there's that element.
I guess the reason my point was that there are some Republicans that live in the 40th district, and what are they going to do, and where are they going to go? And they're not going to vote for those Ds. They're going to vote for the R. And there could be, let's say, and I actually think this is probably pretty accurate, that it's probably about 35% R and 65% D in that district. And so 35% is – so I think – you could work it the other way, that if you said, hey, there's only three Democrats and there's two Republicans, then I think you'd have a really, really strong opportunity. I'm not denying it. I'm just saying that it's less likely because there's four.
And we have a month or so most of June and July before we actually find out. Somebody could drop out. Lots of things could happen. We'll keep you informed as that goes on. I'm just going to touch very lightly on the 42nd because we have covered the 42nd a lot. We've had Pinky Vargas on the show. I've done an extensive interview with Tim Ballew. You can hear both of those interviews at CascadiaNewsNow.com anytime you want. You will not hear a lengthy interview like that anywhere else. Not just in Whatcom County, but anywhere else with these candidates as well. Tim Johnson was it a gristle?
No, it was an article.
A feature piece That's on right. Tim Ballew and Pinky Vargas. So I urge you to pick up 2 days or this week's copy of the Cascadia Weekly if you're interested in that race. We'll be talking about it more. And we have more races that we are going to get to right after this.
The Whatcom Literacy Council – это местная некоммерческая организация, предоставляющая бесплатное репетиторство людям, желающим повысить свою грамотность и знание английского языка. Вы можете получить более подробную информацию, посетив наш веб-сайт или позвонив по номеру 752-86-78.
The Whatcom Literacy Council is a local non-profit that offers free tutoring and small classes to adults who want to improve their literacy skills. For information, check our website or call us at 752-8678.
El Whatcom Literacy Council es un negocio sin fines de lucro que ofrece la tutoría gratis y clases pequeñas para adultos quienes quieren mejorar sus habilidades de leer, escribir y hablar inglés. Para más información, acude a nuestro sitio web o márquenos al 152-8678.
Whatcom Literacy Council. Change a life. Become a tutor.
Create, share, education. We enliven the rich history, legacies, stories, and historical traditions of the Salish people. We endeavor to create understanding and change perceptions across cultural differences, share history, and educate others. We are dedicated to marketing Native American-themed performance arts, as well as making the culture and the history of Native American people accessible. Drawing upon long family traditions, the children of the Setting Sun Productions, multimedia, film, and theater arts, specializing in Coast Salish storytelling. You will find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, or settingsunproductions.org. Heishka.
Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ. I'm Shamaya Katouris. With me in the studios, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and our political pundit of the world, Dave Willingham. So much to talk about. We were talking about how California was a little bit overwhelming. Well, there is no race for me that is as overwhelming in terms of sheer number of candidates than that race for Senate, that is the office currently held by Maria Cantwell. I counted 4 Democrats, 14 Republicans, 5 independents, a Libertarian, a Green Party, a Freedom Socialist Party, a Human Rights Party, a Stand Up American Party, and FDR. Well, it is listed as FDFR on Whatcom's site, and I wondered if it was FDR.
I looked at the state page, and it had it as FDR party, which I have to say, I love when people make up cornball party names, and really, I mean, saying FDR party, that says a lot about who that candidate is, what they stand for, what they want to have happen. It makes you impossible to Google. I will never get any information about this person because there are so many Brads and Chases alongside FDR in stories. So not my favorite pick.
Does anybody remember the Owl Party of the 1970s of Washington State, out with lunacy?
Oh, my gosh.
They actually ran as a credible third party, and they got a couple of candidates in Olympia. I think Treasurer was an Owl Party. It was the entire thing was just a great satire.
Like a rhino.
And the voting guide from that time was just it was beautiful. It was very funny. It was almost like National Lampoon had run some candidates in Washington.
Of course, any of us who've been around for a while in Whatcom County know about the Salmon Yoga Party, which
yes.
I don't know where they've gone. Maybe they're yoga-ing off with the salmon somewhere. We do have Good Space Guy, which is a sunshiny name, I guess, and a whole mess of unknowns. I'm just going to, not to favor anyone, a couple of people whose names stand out for me, Mohammed Saeed, a Democrat who's run very often, and on the Republican side, Susan Hutchinson, who's a former chair.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, the former chair of the state party, and I think probably the front runner.
Correct.
If I'm just picking names out of a hat, I don't see anyone else that has anywhere near the statewide clout.
Gravitas, yeah. You know, it's interesting. When we were talking about the 40th, the thing that made the 40th an interesting race is that there's no incumbent. And when there's an incumbent, that's like just a giant in the room. And I think the narrative of these other races are that you've got giants and then you have other people. Now, a lot of these, this is interesting. We were talking about it before the show, but a lot of these people file for office because they want their campaign statement to appear in the voter guide. That's why they have no aspiration of winning. They just want people to read their statement. And I think that's kind of that's a fun aspiration. You want your party's platform out there, and so you run a candidate. And that's what's going to happen. But I have so much confidence that this is going to end up even though there's scores of candidates, it's going to be a race between Cantwell and Hutchison.
Which will be kind of nice. I mean, it is so far proving that the Trump response and the pushback and the Me Too kind of growth and power, it has shown that there is a lot of strength for women candidates across the country. And I don't know that I would favor Susan Hutchinson a whole heck of a lot, but the idea of having a Republican woman and a Democratic woman run for that position is refreshing.
Yeah, and I got to say that Susan Hutchinson is an able spokesperson for the Republican platform. She was party chair of Washington for a long time. She is formidable. She's a former anchor on Seattle News, and so she is well spoken. She doesn't come across as crazy. She will be a very interesting opponent to Cantwell, who I think is absolutely formidable.
Absolutely. I mean, on the other hand, certainly has a lot of progressive pushback from her sort of moderate.
Yeah, was it the last cycle or the one before? Yeah, you know, speaking of the 36th again, they actually endorsed her opponent in that one. But I have a hard time seeing Cantwell as in any specific danger. She's been an able soldier for the Democratic cause this year, such as it has been, but it will be interesting to see the debates, because Susan Hutchinson has been surprising in the past.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the role of the Senate. They become more valuable and more potent the more time they spend. I mean, I know we talk about term limits and things like that, but actually senators are just, they become extremely useful when they've served a few terms. And the other thing that's interesting about Senate races, and I just tumbled to this a couple of years ago, but they're not gerrymandered. Everybody in the Washington state gets to vote for one of these candidates.
Absolutely.
And it's a very fair contest. The makeup of Washington state tells me that probably Maria is going to win because it's not a gerrymandered race. But we'll see.
Yeah. And sticking with incumbents and federal level races, CD1, Congressional District 1, Susan Del Benny has two Republican challengers, two no party preference challengers. I would stick with the narrative there and say I don't see her under a lot of threat.
I would disagree with that.
Okay. Give me a different perspective.
A little bit. And that is that district was designed to be pretty swingy and pretty competitive between Democrats and Republicans. That's not to say that Susan Del Benny hasn't done an excellent job for that district. I think she has. I think she's been fantastic in terms of her laser focus on the issues of that district as a representative in Washington, D.C. But I do think that that's a very competitive district, and I think she'll have a challenge there.
Well, it might be more competitive than Rick Larson's district.
Correct.
But on the other hand, I do not see her getting the pushback that I think Rick Larson gets very frequently. Her two Republican challengers are Jeffrey Beeler and Scott Stafney, and I don't know much about either of them.
Nor do I. But again, it's one of these issues where are the Republicans going to throw their votes down? And it's a very 50-50 district. It was designed that way.
Well, that's
true,
and that's part of the picture. But part of the picture is name recognition, and part of the picture is why I brought up Rick Larson, is how much ire you've caused as an incumbent. And granted, you cannot move forward without making people unhappy one way or another.
Correct.
But between our two congressional representatives up here, I think Rick Larson has done much more damage in that area, I think, than Del Benny has.
And I guess what I would also say there is that I don't think that this is going to be a big year for Republican gains.
Right.
The narrative and the question in this election is, are the Democrats going to make gains? I don't think anybody's talking about whether the Republicans are going to make gains.
Which doesn't impact our congressional representatives in this part of the state anyway. So Rick Larson has Libertarian, Brian Luke, Uncle Mover, formerly Mike the, who's a moderate GOP, whatever that means. Colin Richard Carlson is a Democrat, or so he says. Gary Franco, independent. And Stonewall Jackson Byrd, or Stony Byrd, who has also made quite a name for himself in both Skagit and Whatcom County.
Yeah, Stoney's been a fixture in super left politics in this part of the state, and I really hope that we get a little bit of a race here. This seems like the district should be a little more competitive for Rick Larson than it is, not from Republicans, but from the left. It is, since the most recent redrawing, it is far to the left than what it used to be.
Correct.
And even those areas that were kind of holding Rick Larson to the middle have gotten bluer in the intervening
Absolutely
time.
Absolutely correct.
And so it would be nice to see an actual race here. And,
here's the way I look at this race. Is Rick Larson going to win? Yeah, he's going to win. But I would really like to put sweat on his brow. I would really like him to get beaten up hard from the left, because I agree with you totally, Dave. This is a district that can take that debate and that dialogue. This might be one of the most liberal congressional districts in the United States after it was redrawn.
And he used to have Oak Harbor. He used to have military bases.
Correct.
There was a reason that Rick Larson was moderate as hell Rick Larson for so long.
Right.
And in my perspective, he got really inured in being that moderate while his district changed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I hear you're kind of throwing it down on the table that it's Rick Larson's race no matter what. However, I do want to say he has been challenged so frequently by Uber progs like Diane McGinnis and our favorite Bob Burr, mm-hmm. and who was LaPont. And we've had a series of, how can I put this nicely, maybe not the most money-raising-est progressive candidates. Stony Byrd is a smart, smart guy. And he's coming from this long line of people with a sense to me of dedication, an ability to articulate the issues, and a groundswell of people who have been supporting anyone but Rick for a decade or so.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to say he's completely ruled out.
No, but what I would say is, if he was taken out, I would cheer. I mean, I'm not. When I make a prediction like that, that's not an aspiration of mine. I actually would love to see him taken out by somebody to the left, because I believe that district would support that kind of a representative.
That's right. And
regardless, like you mentioned, Shemaya, there has not been a strong opponent to Rick Larson that we've seen in recent runs, and part of that is because, there's a lot more to being a congressperson than having the right ideas. You have to be able to run the race. And I really hope that we get that, because that's going to make whoever wins better.
And it is our intention in the weeks to come to interview all of them. So we will do the best we can to do that. Not pictured tonight, Dave McEachran's candidate for his seats, James Urban, Eric Ritchie. You can hear them on our website, CascadiaNewsNow.com. We are almost there with the studio to be back weekly, so stay tuned to our Facebook page, Cascadia News Now. When we come back, not only will I have a new name, you might have noticed that my new name is being used, but our show will have a new name and a new look, if you will. But for now, this has been Cascadia News Now with your hosts, Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, me, Shemaya Contours. Our technical director is also Dave Willingham. Our engineer is the fabulous, fabulous Devlin Sweeney, and Robert Clark stepped in to help tonight. You have been listening to KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.